Hello everyone, my name is Mark Aston. I'm the local history manager here at Islington Museum and Local History Centre, and indeed welcome to Islington Museum. This is the first in a series of events, talks and a few other workshops that looks at the life of two former Islington residents, namely the playwright Joe Orton and his partner Kenneth Halliwell. And you can see some of their handiwork on the walls around us whilst they were resident in Islington. I'm also very pleased to welcome our guest speaker, journalist and writer Christopher Stevens, who is author of the official Kenneth Williams biography here. Williams, of course, probably needs no introduction. I should have asked you, Christopher, how would you describe Kenneth Williams? But I've put down a few things here. Comic actor, carry-on star, letter writer, diarist, and basically all-round unique British institution. I'm sure there's lots of other descriptive words for him. Now, Kenneth Williams, like Orton and Halliwell, was a one-time resident of Islington, albeit for a very short time. He was in fact born in Islington, and for the first 6 months of his life, lived in Bingfield Street, just off Caledonia Road, I think before moving to Bloomsbury or something.
Cromer Street.
Christopher's book sheds light on the relationship, partly on the relationship between playwright Orton and Kenneth Williams, more so the ill-fated tour in 1965 of Joe Orton's farce, Lute. And this is going to be the subject of Christopher's talk tonight. And he's, is it true? He played Inspector Truscott, I think.
Written for him
in the play there. Now, Christopher has titled this rather intriguingly, Kenneth Williams, Joe Orton, and the Debacle of Felicity's 21st Birthday. I can't explain much about that, but I'm sure Christopher will, so please welcome Christopher Stevens. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Mark, very much. Very kind of you all to come, thank you. Are you here for a serious, erudite, literary discussion, or a gossipy ramble? It makes a difference, because for the serious one I sit down, and the casual one I stand up. It's fabulous to be standing here, surrounded by all of these wonderful, intriguing book covers, and rather thought-provoking to wonder what Orton and Williams would have made if they could have been here for the exhibition and seen how the work is so reverently presented. And I don't think it's hard to figure out how each... Can you hear me? Is that all right?
Yeah.
The reason I ask is I did one of these not so long ago, and at the end I said, are there any questions? And a bloke at the back said, yeah, why don't you bleeding speak up? So to avoid that, do shout if you can't hear me. Yeah, it's not hard to imagine what Orton would have made of it. He would have thought it was rank hypocrisy and no more than he expected. And Williams would have thought that it was a sign that the public had gradually caught up with the artist, and that was what he expected. And those two completely different viewpoints really give you an insight into how opposite the two men were, and how diametrically opposed their viewpoints were on everything, not just on art, but on society and on religion as well. I think Orton would have laughed that he was sent to prison for creating these covers, which is, I think, completely gobsmacking, even though it's something that we all know and have considered many times. Every time you say that, he was sent to prison for 6 months, and so was his lover. And it just seems impossible now that anyone could regard it as such a heinous crime. Orton felt that nobody really thought it was an awful crime to deface book covers. What it was an unacceptable act. It transgressed against society's norms, and these were the norms that had to be adhered to in order that society could continue along its path. If somebody attempted to step off the path, they had to be beaten back into line. He felt that that was what had happened to him and to Halliwell. Williams would have felt quite the opposite, that it was truly something that, well, not worthy of imprisonment, something that was beyond description. To mutilate and vandalise public property was something that he could never have countenanced. And indeed, when Williams first visited Orton's flat and saw that it was wallpapered with pages torn out of colour library books, of picture plates, and you've, I'm sure, all seen the photographs of Williams of Orton's flat, that it was ceiling to skirting boards, every single inch, covered in book plates. Orton said, oh, these are torn from a magazine. He guessed that Williams would not approve of them being torn from library books. Williams would have also thought that eventually the general tenor of public opinion would change to the degree that everybody would approve of what Orton did, that it would be acceptable iconoclasm, necessary, and that it was part of Orton's artistic expression. I think Williams was right. I don't think that it's hypocrisy to show these here. I don't think that the people who sent Orton and Halliwell to prison were acting out a part. I think they were genuinely appalled that Orton's lifestyle, in so many ways, and certainly the homophobia at the time was contributory to this, but they were appalled at everything that he did and stood for. And now we see it as one stage in a movement to change the way that everybody thinks about art and about sexuality and about the expression of ideas. It occurred to me on the way up that if you were to put loot on the television now, it certainly wouldn't be a shocking event. It might not even be past the watershed, given that the language is generally not foul and the sexuality is not explicit. And I thought of an episode of a very highly acclaimed drama, The Sopranos, which was, I don't know, about 6, 8, 10 years ago. There was an episode in which Tony Soprano murders a boyhood friend in an argument over a horse and dumps the strangled body in a bath and calls his lieutenant to bring cleavers and a chainsaw, as you would in such a situation. And when they're attempting to chop the body up, one of them grabs hold of the corpse's head by the hair and pulls, and the hair comes away. The gangster was wearing a wig. That is an Orton-esque moment. It is something that could have come from the script of Loot, in which the corpse's glass eye and false teeth both play a part in the story. There's no wig, but that's only probably because Joe couldn't fit it in with the glass eye and the teeth. It would have been over-egging. I think that The Sopranos, although not a direct descendant of Orton's plays, couldn't really have been possible without the boundaries being broken half a century earlier. That play, Loot, it was begun in 1964 on the back of a success called Entertaining Mr. Sloan. That was Orton's first big hit. He had a small radio play, and then Michael Codron produced Sloan, and it was unexpectedly very successful indeed. So successful that one of Orton's pickup lines at the time would be to tell attractive young men that he was considering them for the Hollywood role of Mr. Sloan, and perhaps they'd like to come back to his flat to talk about it. Michael Codron wanted to do something else with Orton, who began a play called Funeral Games. The idea was that the central character was a nurse who had murdered her employer for her money. But to complicate matters, the woman's son was a bank robber who had stashed his loot in his mum's coffin. And an inspector calls, not to apprehend the bank robber, but to claim his cut. The inspector was a very small part when the first draft of the play was finished. But there had to be a role in there somewhere, Codron thought, for Kenneth Williams. So he invited Orton Anne Williams to have dinner with him at his flat, which was then in Cambridge Gate. Codron, it should be said, was an extremely influential producer by this time. He staged the first Harold Pinter success, The Birthday Party. He'd had a huge success with Williams with Pieces of Eight, which was a revue, also starring Fenella Fielding. And he was the West End's most avant-garde producer. He warned Williams that they would have to have the friend. The friend was Halliwell, and he was inseparable from Orton. He went everywhere. Williams took this in his stride to begin with, but afterwards noted in his diary that it was quite extraordinary the way that Halliwell would sit and listen to Orton talk. Orton was dynamic, witty, amusing, energetic, and Halliwell was quiet, reserved, repressed, sibilant when he spoke, he lisped as well, obviously wore a toupee, and seemed to contribute nothing to the conversation except that he would correct any little mistake that Orton made in an anecdote. So that if Orton said, the other Tuesday, we saw, oh, wasn't it Tuesday? No, it was Wednesday. Do you remember, dear? And that seemed to be the subtitle of Halliwell's dynamic in the relationship. I do think if Kenneth could have seen immediately how Orton and Halliwell complemented each other, how one represented the staid lower middle class convention and emphasised it, albeit in a very camp way, and the other constantly transgressed against it, I think he would have understood the dynamic of Orton's writing. But Williams came from a different background, whereas Orton came from the Midlands, East Midlands, Leicester, from a family which had already achieved lower middle class status by the time Orton was about 10 years old. Williams came from a very working class background indeed. He was born, as Mark was saying, in Bingfield Street, but that doesn't tell you very much of the story, because if you go up Bingfield Street now, it's nice little brick-built houses. At the time, it was slums. You can guess the sort of building by walking up Caledonian Road. It's the late 19th century stuff. They would have been rented out, two families to a floor. There would have been six or seven people living on the Williams' floor. Louis and Charlie Williams would have had probably two rooms, one to sleep and live in, and one for a kitchen. There would have been an outside toilet, probably shared by several other families. Certainly shared. Williams was born at home, and his father happened to be there because he was a journeyman hairdresser, and it was, I think, a Monday afternoon, and Monday afternoons were his afternoon off, so he was able to help the midwife. Louis had already another child who was not Charlie Williams' child and had not been born at home. In fact, I discovered during the research for the biography that Pat Williams, the older sister, was born in Islington Workhouse. Her birth certificate gives a rather anodyne address, 419 Islington, I read, I think. If you look that address up, you'll see that it is a generic address given to all birth certificates, put on all birth certificates, for children born in the workhouse infirmary. Louis had been engaged, 1921 or 1922, to a chap called Ted Scarfe, who, when he found out that his bride-to-be was pregnant, left her. It was only a couple of weeks before the wedding. The first banns had already been read. Louis was thrown back on her family. She went to her older sister, Alice. Alice's father was a milkman, and their daughter, Joan, is still alive. Joan told me that her father was a very meek, mild, quiet man. But he was so angry when he heard that his sister-in-law was pregnant before marriage and now going to be a single mother, so angry that he hit her. And Louis felt that that was getting off lightly. All through her life, she would refer to her shame. She would say, I had Pat in my shame. Right up to the end of her life. And she was so ashamed that Pat was born in the workhouse that she never told her, and she never told Kenneth. They knew that Pat was illegitimate and that Charlie wasn't her father, although father he was, because Charlie adopted her in 1926 when he married Lily. But the workhouse was never mentioned to either Pat or to Ken. Charlie Williams, a hairdresser, as I said, had been born in Sydney Street. And if I said Bingfield Street was a slum, Sydney Street was something else. It was supposed to be the worst district in the whole of London. King's Cross Station stands on those slums now. Dan Leno, the comic, who was the sensation around the turn of the century, was born on one of the lots where Platform 1 now stands. It was the lowest sort of habitation, 9 families to a house, and very often the house would only have half of a roof, rat infested. Charlie grew up knowing that this was how you lived if you didn't have any money at all, because obviously there was no social security. And the only way of being certain of having any money was to have a trade. He started as a van boy on the London and Midlands Railway, but he trained up as a hairdresser after leaving the armed forces in 1919. He'd been an infantryman. And he plied his trade as a hairdresser until the 40s, when he was able to buy his own business and manage a little hairdressing shop in Marchmont Street. The hairdressing shop is still there. It's called CV Hair and Beauty. And if you stick your head around the door and say, Kenneth Williams, they'll either be very nice to you or they'll chuck you out on your ear, depending on how they're feeling that day. Charlie Williams continued to run that business until he went bankrupt in the 50s. Kenneth learned 2 lessons from Charlie. 1, you should have a trade that you can fall back on so that you can always make a living. And the 2nd was pay your taxes so you don't go bankrupt when the income tax man comes calling. Well, he always did pay his taxes, Kenneth Williams, and his diaries are full, and I mean every week there's some reference to making sure that he had enough money in the bank to pay what he considered to be the forthcoming tax bill. He always overestimated what the tax bill was going to be, and he always had enough to cover it. What he never did have was a trade, because when Kenneth came out of the armed forces in 1947, he'd spent 18 months in combined services entertainment in Singapore and Burma. That was what you'd think of as It Ain't Half Hot Mum, the boys on stage doing the gang reviews in their uniforms. They used to wear yellow tunics and blue trousers. Stanley Baxter was another in the troupe. He told me that he'd complained that the outfit made them look like camp sergeants. Which the major said, well, you are sergeants and you are camp, so get out there. Williams was certainly the star turn of those performances, those squaddy gang shows. Stanley admitted that compared to all the others, and there were some great performers there, including Peter Nichols, the playwright, was one of them, and John Schlesinger, who went on to become a very successful film director, and of course Stanley, who was, whether anybody remembers him now, but in the 60s and 70s he was the most highly paid comic on television. But without any doubt, Kenneth Williams was the star of those shows. The great quality that he had was to be able to win over a hostile audience almost immediately. The show would start with a sing-song, a bit like It Ain't Half Hot Mum, if you remember We're the boys who are here to entertain you, all high-kicking, sort of like a can-can. And the troops would think that was pretty lame, not funny, not tuneful, and they would start off the show with jeering and catcalls. And Stanley said that Kenneth would manoeuvre himself to the end of the high-kicking line. As they all danced off, he'd dance along the back of them, goosing them. Reach the end of the line, go as if to be the last one off stage, with the jeers and the whistles following, and he'd turn, and he'd say, oh, I'm not with that lot. I hope you don't think I've got anything to do with them. And pull them around. And within a few seconds, they'd be laughing. He'd go into a really quick-fire routine of impressions. impression so fast that there would only be half a line or so. He had 20 or 30 people from Churchill to all sorts of radio stars, a lot of people that nobody would remember now, well, often not remembered even in 1947. There would be people like the Western Brothers, who were popular music hall act of the 1930s, Felix Aylmer, who was a sort of a stuffy judge-type character, and I'm not sure that troops in Singapore would have known very much of, but he could do these impressions so fast that even if you didn't know who he was doing, you got the impression that it was very funny and very clever. And he would rattle them off very fast and then go into a Noel Coward song. By the time he was off stage, everybody was cheering. It was inevitable when he went home from Singapore at the end of 1947 that he would have to go onto the stage, even though that was not a trade. And his father was horrified by the idea of him becoming a full-time actor, partly because everybody on stage was a Nancy boy, and partly because there was no security in it. Kenneth did try very hard to pick up a trade. He considered a job at the Water Board, which he'd been offered in writing, but he then returned to the Mapmakers, where he'd been working in 1944 before he was called up. He managed a week in the printers, but by the time he came back from Singapore, his personality was completely formed, and his mannerisms, as we would know them from Parkinson shows in the 70s, Just a Minute in the 80s, that very camp, nasal voice, was fully formed. And you can imagine that in a printer's workshop, he couldn't survive. And a week of the intense mockery and homophobic abuse and bullying had him completely in tears. On the Saturday, he walked, this was January 1948, he walked through the snow to the Labour Exchange on a Saturday morning to ask whether it was legal for a working man to change his trade. He really wasn't sure. And they said, yes, you can. So he went back to his father and said, I think I'm going to have to be a hairdresser because I can't be a printer. And Charlie was delighted. He said, I'll train you. Well, that wasn't what Kenneth had in mind at all. He loved his father and he respected him very much, but they didn't get on for a few minutes they'd be fine, but spend the day together and they would be at each other's throats. Charlie was overbearing and Kenneth was a show-off. Kenneth took after his mother, who was also a show-off, and while Louis could get away with it because she would be entertaining the customers while they waited to have their hair cut, and she'd be gossiping and telling stories and doing little dances and songs, that's all right from the woman behind the till. It's not quite all right for the junior hairdresser who's supposed to be learning the trade of cutting hair. And Kenneth knew that it wouldn't work. So he started writing to repertory companies, and within a few days he had three offers. He chose the one that was furthest away from his parents. He went to Newquay in Cornwall, and that was the beginning of his theatre career in England. 2 years later, he was working in High Wycombe, again in rep, and it was pretty hateful. It was some sort of pantomime. I think it was Treasure Island, and it was a dreadful script and a pretty awful cast, and Kenneth was feeling quite hysterical. He came home one night, very tired, to find that the whole family was waiting up. Pat had come back from Australia, where she'd been living with her husband, but they'd just separated, so she'd come home, did it at home. That had put a lot of pressure on everybody. Louis was never pleased to see Pat. Louis didn't like Pat. She tried to look after her and to regard her as a daughter, which of course she was, but she never liked her, and Pat always sensed that she was certainly second best, because Louis worshipped her son, Kenneth. So there was that tension. There was the tension that Kenneth was in theatre but was clearly not doing all that well and was not enjoying it and was coming home and whinging. And I suspect that there was also enormous tension because Charlie, whose financial troubles were well underway by 1950, was drinking very heavily. So there was a family discussion, and Kenneth was sniping at Pat, and Pat came back knowing where Kenneth's weak point, saying that Kenneth didn't have a proper job, that he didn't have a legitimate profession. Well, that was an interesting choice of words. Kenneth turned on her and said, oh, we're talking about legitimate now, are we? And that really opened a can of worms. And Pat, and you could never say that Pat didn't defend herself, she was not a shrinking violet. Pat outed him to his mum and dad. Kenneth always denied that he was inclined to homosexuality. He'd certainly never had a serious relationship, either male or female, but he had carried on the pretense of courting one or two girls. And his mum and dad were waiting for him to meet the right girl, and Pat put paid to that notion. It all came out. That was Kenneth's upbringing, so that 15 years later, 1964, when he met Autumn, he was by now a very successful actor in radio through Hancock's Half Hour and then Beyond Our Ken, which was the biggest, I mean nobody remembers Beyond Our Ken now, but it was the biggest show for 7 years on BBC Radio. In Pieces of Eight and One Over the Eight, which were West End smashes that ran for a combined 2.5 years and packed them out every single night. He had starred in a play written for him by Robert Bolt, who was the biggest name in British theatre, with A Man for All Seasons having swept the board of all the awards. The next play that Bolt wrote was called Gentle Jack. And in fact, it was Gentle Jack that had just finished when Williams met Autumn. Gentle Jack was about the god Pan. Robert Bolt saw Williams as the animal spirit in man, the unfettered urge of man to create mischief, amoral, simply intent on wreaking havoc. And he wrote a play which cast Williams as this mythic personality. Williams doesn't come in until halfway through the play, and when he does enter, he comes down on a vine from the lights at the top of the theatre. He descends to the stage, and his first act is to draw a huge knife, seize a dog, put it towards him, gut the animal from spleen to throat, and spill its entrails out towards the audience. Maggie Smith said to him after the first night, darling, they're going to find it awfully hard to love you after that. The play bombed. It ran 60, 62 performances, of which most were much less than full. I mean, just a smattering of people. And Williams was feeling vulnerable after this, not least because he knew the play had been written for him. And although ostensibly it had starred Edith Evans, he knew that Bolt had hinged everything on his character. He believed that he carried it off, and he played the part as well as it could be played. It was just that the play was unstomachable, rather like the dog. He needed a success with his next play, and he considered several things. Ray Cooney offered to write a farce for him. He did a thing on television where he was Napoleon, believe it or not, and was scolded for playing too much of it with his hand inside his tunic. He just finished doing Carry On Cleo, which is one of the very funniest of the Carry On movies. He was in a pretty foul mood when he was making Carry On Cleo. You might remember Amanda Barry is Cleopatra, and there is a scene where she bathes in milk. And the Carry On sets were usually not busy, because there weren't that many stagehands. The producer, Peter Rogers, would make sure that he didn't have to hire any more people than was absolutely necessary. And so it was not common to have a crowded set, but apparently for the scene where Amanda Barry is bathing in milk, they were hanging over the gantries. For some reason, everybody had an excuse to be on set. Kenneth was furious. He didn't like Amanda anyway, because they'd done a little bit of television together, and he thought she was a scene stealer. Fancy that, a scene stealer! And so he had a little bit of revenge on her. While she was bathing in milk, he went to the rack of dressing gowns. They each had a dressing gown. All the dressing gowns were pretty similar. And he hung his dressing gown on her peg. So that when she dashed out of the milk bath and grabbed her dressing gown, He strode up to her and said, "That is my dressing gown. You have stolen it. You must give it back immediately." And she said, "All right, I'll get to my dressing room and I'll change." "No, I have to have it now." And he tried to take it off. He tried physically to pull it off her back. Sid James came to her rescue with another. You can imagine it would be Sid James, wouldn't you? With another dressing gown, and wrapped her up and bundled her off. Williams was acting out at the time a lot of the frustrations and anxieties that he was feeling about his stage career. He really didn't care too much about the Carry-Ons. They paid the rent and they kept his name before the audience, but he recognised that he was coasting through them all the way. He didn't have to try too hard to make the material work, and he felt to make himself the star, even if there was nominally no star. Peter Rogers always insisted that the Carry-On name was the star, but I think Kenneth knew who was the most magnetic personality on the screen. He was much more concerned about making sure that he had a huge hit with his next play. He sat down in Cambridge Gate with Orton and he ignored Halliwell's little interruptions and corrections, and he listened to Orton talk about his next play, and he said, "Sounds good, the bank robbery, the notes in the coffin, but there doesn't seem to be anything for me." And Orton said, "I'll write something for you, I'll put something in for you, I'll create a character for you." And they both realised months afterwards in retrospect that that's almost an impossible task, to rewrite a play so that a completely new character can be introduced and to write that part for a specific actor. To make it worse, Orton had only met Williams once, at least when Bolt wrote a play, Gentle Jack. At least he knew Kenneth Williams very well, they'd been friends for years. Orton had seen Williams once in Pieces of Eight, in a short sketch, a 2-minute blackout sketch it's called, at the end of the sketch, instead of a punchline, the lights go out, that's all. And in this little play, I think it was a Peter Cook one actually, it was done with Fenella Fielding, and it was about a man who feels he could have been the greatest fat man who ever lived, if only been able to put weight on. It was the milk that did it for me. It was the refrain all the way through this little sketch. It was a bizarre, surreal little Peter Cook thing that hinged on the idea that this man was terribly downtrodden and spoke in a little monotone like that, very tremulous. And his wife was a great, roaring, blousy creature, which Fenella did very well. And Orton wanted that character, that monotone, nasal, unimaginative, and monotonous, and unceasing. The kind of personality that cannot be diverted. It was how Orton saw middle-class justice. The same council and magistrate system which had sent Orton to prison, he wanted to represent in a character in Lute, and this character was going to be a policeman. Further complicated by the fact that there was, or had just been, a huge court case, the first ever Metropolitan Police inquiry into malpractice and corruption. Now, thank goodness we don't have any of that in the Metropolitan Police anymore, but at the time, people were very upset. The image of the police was Dixon of Dock Green, an avuncular, utterly trustworthy policeman who stands in front of you, bows his legs a couple of times, in a relaxing yet somehow still authoritative and disciplined manner, and tells you a story, the absolute truth of which cannot be doubted. Well, the prosecution was of a man called Harold Challoner, who was a detective sergeant who had the best arrest and prosecution rates in the whole of the Met. Tanky Challoner, they called him. He'd served through the Second World War with the SAS, Special Forces, from 1943. He'd been decorated with the Military Medal for his bravery behind the Italian lines in 43. In 1945, he had been one of the guards and inquisitors of a group of captured Gestapo men in Germany. He beat a Gestapo man to death with his fists in that camp. Asked afterwards why he'd done it, he said the bastard was smiling at him. Tanki Challoner was an aggressive personality. He brought those qualities into the Metropolitan Police, and he became obsessed with his personal legend. He was so convinced that he was a superman that he would perform feats of impossible physical endurance to impress himself. His wife said that he once went out for a walk in a rainstorm and came back 17 hours later dry, having walked himself dry, with blood seeping through his boots from the blisters. He did have this extraordinary arrest record. He had arrested more people than anyone else on the force, and a surprising number of them confessed not only to what they were charged with, but just about anything else they could think of. One man arrested at a demonstration happened to be a Peace News cartoonist, a notoriously vicious bastard, as I'm sure you can imagine all Peace cartoonists are. This Peace News fellow was beaten up 7 times between being picked up and thrown into the van and the time he was dragged out of the cell. 7 separate occasions Challoner gave him a working over before he was charged. And what he was then charged with was half a brick was thrown into his lap and he was charged with possession of an offensive weapon. Orton thought this was fantastic. He loved it. William said that he couldn't stop reading the reports of this inquiry over and over in hysterical laughter. He wanted to put them verbatim into his play. And in fact, some of Challoner's lines are in the play. When Inspector Truscott says to the innocent man, at the end of the play, the innocent man is the one who's arrested and dragged away. And Truscott says, "You're fucking nicked, my old beauty." And that was taken from the inquiry's transcript. Williams was not, I think, the ideal actor to play a policeman based on Tanki Challoner. Challoner was built like an ox. Williams was a very slight fellow of about 5'7". Challoner was a psychopathically violent man. Williams fantasized about violence done against him. He was a masochistic person who never dared put his fantasies into action. He would never have raised a hand to anybody. Challoner was an utterly unimaginative man, the most straightforward thinker you could imagine. Everybody was guilty and everybody deserved to be punished, and he was the wrath of God. Now, Williams was incapable of suppressing imagination. Williams could not find a mode of playing Inspector Truscott, as the character is called. The play opened in early 1965, about 4 months after Williams first met, 5 months after Williams first met Orton. Opened at the Cambridge Arts Theatre, and they were going to do a tour of 6 or 8 theatres before coming into the West End. Codron was one of the producers. Donald Albury, who is the Don of the Donmar Theatre. I think Margot Fonteyn's the Mar. He was the other producer. Donald Albury hated it from the start. He didn't like Sloane, he didn't like Orton, he didn't like the idea of a farce about a corpse and a coffin full of money. And he was determined that it shouldn't make the West End. So it got off to the worst possible start. But Codron believed in the play and he believed in Orton. He wasn't sure that he believed in Williams as Truscott, but he wanted to see what could happen. It had a very strong cast. The nurse, Faye, was played by Geraldine McEwan. The mother's bank robber son was played by Ian McShane, Lovejoy and Al Swearingen. And the script was an utter mess. They didn't know from the very first night what the finished script looked like. In fact, a couple of nights before it opened, Orson produced a prelude to the play in which a new character, the inspector's sidekick, and the policeman himself walk across the front of the stage pushing a pram in which there is a gramophone playing Abide With Me. And they're arguing about whether their boots give them away as policemen. Had nothing to do with the action that followed, which is all set inside a middle-class home with a coffin. Sometimes the coffin is out on the table, sometimes the coffin is empty and on the bed with the corpse upside down and stark naked in the wardrobe. That's one more laugh than it got on the first night, I can tell you. Williams didn't want to do the thing with the pram and protested violently. There was a major row. The director, Peter Wood, ordered him to do it. They did do it. It died the death. Then the whole of the play was an anticlimax of colossal proportions all the way through, and the reviews in the Cambridge Times were damning. The critic really put it to bed. He said it was an evening of very British rubbish. They had to go in and do it the next night. Only Orson had already done a couple of pages of changes. So they rehearsed the changes in the afternoon, and then they played the play the next night. They played the play that night the way that they'd done it the previous night, without the changes. And then the next night, they played the play with the previous afternoon's changes, but they'd already rehearsed some more changes that Orton had written that day. And that went on. It went on through Cambridge and Brighton and Oxford and Golders Green and Bournemouth and Manchester and Wimbledon. 7 different venues. 55 nights. An 89-page play had 133 pages of inserts written into it. And they rehearsed all of them, page by page, and then went on and played the previous day's rehearsal as that night's performance. Can you imagine the chaos? By the time they reached Manchester, Geraldine McEwan was in the throes of a nervous breakdown. She left the stage screaming so that the audience could hear, "I cannot go on with this," and she was taken home and given sedation. That is William's account in his diary. It's Orton's account in his diary, and although I contacted Miss McEwan, she didn't want to comment, and I think that's completely understandable. The director, Peter Wood, didn't help matters because he really couldn't understand what the play was about. He thought that it must be some sort of 18th century restoration farce brought up to date, and that it should be played like that. So he had the set designed as a pop art cartoon backdrop of all black and white, no colour at all. This is supposed to be an ordinary middle class home, but everything, the furnishings, the walls, everything is black and white, swirling shapes. He asked the cast to present all violence as though it was exaggerated Tom and Jerry violence. That's how he described it. He wanted it to be like a Tom and Jerry cartoon. And he asked the pace to be to a precise rhythm. Not naturalistic, quite the opposite. As though you were reading it by rhythm. And when the cast refused, he threatened to install a metronome. Orton had screaming rows with everybody. Ian McShane thumped him, gave him a black eye. Williams had screaming rows with everybody, managed not to get thumped, smoked so heavily, he was always a heavy smoker, but smoked so much that he lost his voice. He smoked himself hoarse. Everybody agreed it was an absolute horror show. Fenella Fielding went to see it and told me that she couldn't see a single redeeming feature in it, simply that Ken could not find any way of playing Truscott. And he did try. He played it as Heinrich Himmler in a Gestapo greatcoat, which is quite ironic, really, when you consider what Tanguy Challoner used to do to Gestapo officers. He played it as Snide, the Hancock's half-hour character, and spoke with a very nasal voice. Good evening. He did it like that. He did it as every voice from Beyond Arcane, including the little old man who'd been doing it for 35 years. He tried every voice he possibly could, and the more he tried to do voices, the more Orton hated him, because it wasn't supposed to be done in funny voices. Oddly, that was why Williams had been sacked from Hancock's Half Hour, because Tony Hancock and the writers, Ray Gorton and Alan Simpson, didn't want funny voices in that sitcom either. The whole idea of that prototype sitcom was that it should be completely naturalistic. There were no gags, no catchphrases, no breaks for a song, and no silly voices. And as Ray Gorton says, that all of that went out the window when they got Kenneth Williams. Until Kenneth Williams had been moved out, they couldn't achieve what they wanted to. And if you want to know what they were really striving for, you have to look at the last series of Hancock on television, when they'd even got rid of Sid James, and it was just Hancock by himself. And that is naturalistic sitcom. In the first episode, in fact, it's just Hancock on his own in a bedsit. Orton was trying to do something similar. He wasn't as naturalistic a writer as Gorton and Simpson. He was intent on holding up the, come back to that word, hypocrisy, holding up the hypocrisy of the phrases that the middle class used as their props. So everything that the nurse says to justify her murder and theft, everything that the bank robber says to justify his violence, everything that the father says to try and prove to himself that he was a decent father and he's raised a good son, all of the language that those characters use is empty and meaningless. Because that is how Orton saw, especially his own class, but humanity as a whole. And if Williams couldn't do it for Gorton and Simpson, he certainly couldn't do it on stage for Joe Orton. When they opened in Brighton, Laurence Olivier came to see them. He came backstage and he put an arm around Kenneth and he said, "You know your problem here, dear boy, you haven't got a play." By which he meant there was simply no continuity to what was falling out of the typescript, with different sheets, contradictions, characters appearing, characters disappearing, the same thing being said over and over, a complete muddle. And on top of that, and what I think the audience has found even harder to enjoy or understand, was the banality of the evil, the way that everybody accepted, except this poor man at the centre of it, that there was nothing wrong with stripping a corpse and dumping it upside down in a wardrobe because it was just a cadaver. And there was nothing wrong with hiding the loot from bank robbery in a coffin because it was just a box. And as I say, audiences brought up on The Sopranos can laugh at that. Audiences in Wimbledon, 1965, at the end of one performance, a lady marched up to Michael Codron. She was shaking with anger and dragging a young woman who was in tears. And all the lady said to Michael Codron was, "It was Felicity's 21st! At Wimbledon, Michael Codron, up to the very last moment, was hoping to bring the play into London. He was hoping that it would have a West End opening. There was a theatre in Charing Cross called The Phoenix, which was the theatre of last resort, as Codron put it to me. It was the place that you only played if you could get nowhere else. And that night, while Luke was playing on stage, Michael was in a phone box outside waiting for a call from The Phoenix, and when it came through, the Phoenix manager said to them, "I would rather stay dark next week than have your play." Everybody was relieved, I think, backstage when Codron, even Orton, was relieved that that version of the play was not going to go into the West End, because, well, certainly Geraldine McEwan wouldn't have done it. I think Kenneth probably would, but as we've said for a thousand reasons, he wasn't the suitable person to do it. When Play eventually did open in the West End, completely rewritten in the version that you'll be able to buy out in the foyer, it was rewritten again, streamlined, and I don't think it's possible now to find copies of the completely anarchic versions that went round the provinces. It's a terrible tragedy that even though there were reel-to-reel recorders, nobody thought to have one playing, not only at that play, but indeed at any of Kenneth's plays. There's no recording of Gentle Jack, for example, or of Pieces of Eight, or of anything else that he did. One or two studio albums of songs from the reviews, but no bootlegs of plays, which is... When you consider that there's somebody sitting here with a camcorder, I think it's utterly ridiculous that these days, I mean, you can't do anything without it being completely recorded, probably from four different angles. And yet all of that is lost. I would love to be able to see that first night at Cambridge, starting with the Pram and Abide With Me. I would see it from a very different perspective, just as the way we see these book covers from a very different perspective. Before I wind up and take questions, I will say there was a corollary. Orton died, as you know, in 67. Kenneth collaborated with Orton's biographer, John Lahr. Williams also put on, directed, two of Orton's plays at the Lyric Hammersmith in 1980 and 81. He was invited to do it by Bill Kenwright, who was desperately trying to get Williams to play something, anything, on the West End. What he really wanted was for Kenneth to do an audience with. But Kenneth only ever did that once on a television studio floor, and you can get that's still available on DVD, but he only ever did that performance once. He never did it in a West End theatre, and he refused all of Kenwright's blandishments and flattery and praise and encouragement and whatever. But there was a funny thing. About 1980, Kenneth's agent died, and while he was between agents, he entered a sort of a free-floating state, and he did a play. It was his first even partially successful play since Gentle Jack. It was called The Undertaking, and it was quite Ortonesque. It was about an undertaker who specialises in burying people in fetishistic ways. If your whole life you've dreamed of being a pharaoh, for a consideration, he would partially mummify your body and sit you on a throne and build a pyramid for you. Very expensive, but a select clientele consider it worth the investment. And the plot of this is that he's buried one of his clients in a thoroughly compromising position without realising that she isn't actually dead. She's only in a coma. And when she wakes up... Well, anyway. Kenneth was the undertaker. And he enjoyed that so much, even though it wasn't a massive hit. It did make the West End. Lorraine Chase was the girl who was buried. When it was suggested to him that he could direct Entertaining Mr. Sloane and Loot first, he was thoroughly enthused. He thought that would be wonderful, a tribute to Joe. And he dug out the inscribed copy of Loot, which Orson had given him, and he used it to direct a week-long run of Loot with John Malcolm, who was a journeyman act, as Truscott. But Malcolm wasn't just a journeyman, he was also a hard drinker who frequented some pretty ill-natured pubs. And a couple of nights into the run, Malcolm got himself duffed up really quite badly in a pub after the show. And he couldn't make the next night's performance, owing to the fact that he was in splints and bandages, and possibly still in hospital. And Kenneth announced that he would play the part himself. And he enlisted his neighbour, Paul Richardson, to whom he eventually left his diaries and his papers, to read him through the part. And so Richardson read all the other characters, and Kenneth read Truscott. They went through it twice, with Kenneth constantly exhorting him to put some feeling into it. And Richardson, who was a ballet, not a dancer, far from it, he was a theatre manager at Sadler's Wells. And he was stoically reading his way through Lute, and Kenneth, after two read-throughs, knew the part. And to reassure himself, had his lines put down on a clipboard, because he felt clipboard was the kind of thing that Truscott officiously might carry. And he marched out on stage, and he did Truscott in the most over-the-top and riotously funny-voiced characterisation that you could imagine. And he tore the house down. The guy who ran front of house had been run off his legs all day, as people heard that Kenneth Williams was going to be playing Truscott that night. This, only 15 years after they couldn't keep an audience throughout the whole of a play in Cambridge or Bournemouth or whatever, in Bournemouth in particular, Joe Orton said that the only sound he could hear throughout the play was thump, bang, thump, bang, as the theatre seats went up and people walked out. He called them the Bump and Trot Brigade, as they all trotted out of the theatre. And in fact, Orton used to lurk at the back of the theatre to listen to the Bump and Trot Brigade as they left, and he'd note down what they were saying as they left. It's awful. It's all about pregnancy. Things like that. Contrast that, 15 years later at the Lyric Hammersmith, when word goes out that Kenneth Williams is playing Truscott, they were besieged all day. The phones rang off the hook, and people were queuing around the block in the hope of returns. And when the curtain went up on the front row, Mick Jagger and Jerry Hall had got seats. And it was a real triumph. And although Kenneth played it nothing like it was supposed to be played, everybody loved it. And Bill Kenwright was begging him to take it into the West End, and I'm quite sure if he had, it would have lasted months. Instead, it was the last time Kenneth Williams ever stepped onto a stage. He did television studio work, and he did film work, but he never walked out onto a theatre again. And I think it's quite poignant that their lives ended 20 years apart. Kenneth died in 1988. But somehow their path in theatre was absolutely inextricably wound together. Well, that's quite enough of me yakking. Would anybody like to ask any questions? Or have I talked about absolutely everything?
Following the year, 1966, was a successful revival of Lute. In fact, I think Orton won the Evening Standard Best Play Award for that year. Was there any record of how Kenneth Williams felt about the revival and the success at all? Or?
Kenneth was hurt. Not hurt that he hadn't been asked to play Truscott, because he recognised he was entirely wrong for the part. He was hurt that that anybody should have a success with it. It would have been much better if it had been buried and forgotten about. And Orton did recognise that it was going to be a delicate subject. Orton, although he was completely cynical about other people's feelings, and he didn't believe in the sincerity of anybody's, he did also recognise that they had to be treated as though they were genuine grievances. And so he sent Kenneth a copy of the, as I say, an inscribed copy of the play, and as a present he sent him a tie and a note, which is still in Kenneth's boxes of letters, a note that says, I picked this out for you specially, because I thought it was exactly the sort of thing that you would choose. Complete lie. Actually, Peter Wood, the director of Lute, had given it to him, and Orton didn't like it because he didn't wear ties. So it was a cynical little lie. There was also a flattering little addendum to the letter saying, I would have called on you, but the only day I'm free is Sundays, and I know that Sundays you're very busy learning lines for Round the Horn, and I'd hate to be inconsiderate and to bother you, which was clever of him,
because it was both flattering and it showed consideration. And Kenneth Williams expected both. He expected a little bit of flattery and he valued very much consideration. I don't think Autumn was at all considerate in real life. At heart, I mean. But he knew how to imitate it. So that built bridges back between them. Williams invited Autumn to do Call My Bluff with him on the team, and there was talk of them doing a chat show together, though that didn't come off. He certainly advised Autumn on how to do chat shows. And they did a holiday together in Tangiers in 1967, just a few weeks before Autumn was killed. I can talk about Autumn and Tangiers if you want.
How did Kenneth Williams respond in the diaries to Joel's death?
He was absolutely numb. There was there were a couple of really quite sad synchronicities around the death. The first was that on the night that Halliwell beat Autumn to death, Williams was at home with a friend called George Borick, who was also a Tangiers pal. Borick used to put money up for theatre productions. He was very wealthy. And they both knew Autumn, and Williams was despairing of Autumn's lifestyle. We don't quite know what Autumn was up to in the last weeks of his life, because those pages of his diary were taken by the police for the coroner before the inquest, and they were never replaced. Whether they're still extant in some police file or not, I don't know. Nobody knows. Friends of Autumn have said that there was a new love interest on the scene, somebody serious, and that Halliwell would have felt very threatened by that. Friends of Kenneth's, who knew Autumn and Halliwell well, said that Joe Autumn was completely oblivious to his lover's suffering during his last couple of years. Halliwell didn't recover from the prison experience. He attempted suicide shortly after leaving prison. He slipped into a long depression, which was certainly exacerbated by his complete lack of recognition as an artist. He felt that he'd taught Autumn everything he knew about writing, and now Autumn was celebrated and he was the one being asked on chat shows. And although Halliwell attempted to be inseparable from his lover, it was in the end impossible to get yourself on camera or to pick up the awards or to be interviewed at the same time as the playwright himself. He was gradually being sidelined. And there was no question that Autumn, by 67, was actively sidelining Halliwell, that he wanted rid of him. He was considering setting him up in a guest house in Tangier and trying to facilitate that. And if Halliwell wouldn't go for that, to get him a boarding house somewhere on the English south coast. Halliwell didn't want either of those things, of course. He wanted to be a successful artist, which was impossible. He also wanted to be happy, which was impossible. He was taking a lot of Librium. Autumn's interest in Halliwell's depression extended exactly as far as the Librium tablets, which he found quite amusing to experiment with. Apart from that, no interest. In those last months, Kenneth became quite friendly with Halliwell in particular. I think Kenneth found that he could lift Halliwell's spirits by visiting him and talking to him. And he recognised that Halliwell, like one or two of Williams' other friends, was a chronic depressive, and Williams found that comforting to talk about. Williams wasn't a chronic depressive. He wasn't continually depressed for long periods of time, but he did suffer terrible downs after a performance during which he would be very highly wound up and very excitable, and that could be a performance for friends, you know, just talking to a couple of people in the pub. Or it could be on stage, or it could be a radio thing, or a chat show, or whatever. He would be very wound up, very excitable. Nicholas Parsons told me that you've never seen anybody quite so electrified by the excitement of going out in front of an audience. And inevitably afterwards, there is a crash. All performers, proper performers, feel it. Any actor must feel that, you know, the seeping away, the ebbing away of the adrenaline. And most actors will go and share that with somebody. Most people are in a relationship after all, one sort or another, even if it's just having a dog. All Kenneth had was his diary. And a lot of the entries following the day's performance, because Kenneth wrote his diary through the day, but the section at the bottom of the page would be written after a performance, or after a party, or after a dinner out with friends, and the beginning of the passage is always excitable. Which, if you read the extracts of Kenneth's diaries that were published, ones that Russell Davis edited, you don't always get this sense. That at the beginning of the extract there's excitement and a sense of immense pleasure at having entertained and been entertaining, even if it was a dreadful night, this energy going into the description of what awful people there were and what terrible things he'd done and said to them. But as he wound down, in the course of three or four sentences, a note of sourness and bitterness would emerge, and by the end of almost every entry there is a despair that he should have wasted another day and have nothing to show for it at the end, because here he is completely alone. And indeed his whole diary finishes on that note, that famous line, "Oh, what's the bloody point?" Well, a lot of his entries finish on that sort of emotion. So talking to Kenneth Halliwell was quite therapeutic for Kenneth, because he was somebody who was going through continuous depression and was taking serious medication for it. Halliwell had become very fond of marijuana in Tangier. The first time they went was 1966, and Halliwell got a taste for it, brought some back, and then started buying it in London. He didn't like to smoke it, he liked to bake it. He put it in cakes. And a couple of Williams's friends, Tom Wayne and Clive Dennis, told me that they went round to dinner with Autumn and Halliwell and Kenneth Williams one evening, and after the meal, which was a haddock fish pie, everybody was feeling rather strange and giggly. And cake was served, and by the time they'd eaten the cake, Tom and Clive knew exactly what was going on, because they could taste the dope in the cake. And Kenneth Williams, who had never knowingly ingested an illegal substance, had no idea what was happening. All he knew was that he was laughing harder at his own jokes than anybody else. And Halliwell and Autumn were curled up on the floor, and they didn't seem to be laughing at Kenneth's jokes, they seemed to be laughing at the fact that Kenneth was laughing. And in the end, they told him what they'd done. Kenneth Williams was furious, absolutely outraged, but also very quick to forgive, because he recognised that everything he admired most in Joe Autumn was that mischievous, prankster, schoolboy humour. In fact, Peter Wood, that director, said that he regarded Autumn and Williams as a pair of schoolboys in cahoots. It was like having a couple of third formers constantly pulling the girls' pigtails. And on the night of Autumn's death, Williams was discussing the Halliwell-Autumn situation with George Borrick. And you read that night, the 24th of August, you read him saying, "I talked late into the night with George about Autumn's promiscuity and how it can't go on, because this way lies destruction. Something terrible will happen if he carries on living like this." And I think there's a terrible poignancy in the fact that as he was writing that, his friend was dying. The following day, Clive Dennis, the Clive of Tom and Clive, who was a GPO engineer, had come to fix Ken's telephone, the phone socket they'd been playing up. And there was a funny thing about that phone socket, because it was the device by which Ken Williams had introduced Clive Dennis to Autumn and Halliwell. He'd invited Autumn and Halliwell to his flat, and they arranged for Clive, the telephone engineer, to come and fix his phone and fix the socket. And he said to Clive, "Make sure you bring all your tools, because if you just turn up looking your Sunday best, they're going to smell a rat immediately. You've got to look like a workman." What he was trying to do, and this was mischievous, knowing that Orton's promiscuity was the big problem between Orton and Halliwell. He was trying to get Clive Dennis to Orton's attention. This was because Kenneth loved to hear stories of people's sexual exploits. And Clive Dennis was, and is, I must say, a very uninhibited teller of saucy stories. If you ever meet him, ask him about Rudolf Nureyev. And he knew that if anything went on between Joe and Clive, he'd hear about it twice, once from Orton and once from Clive. Actually, if you read Joe's diary, there is an episode between the two of them which Clive insists, and I'm inclined to believe Clive because he doesn't normally fib about these things, insists is completely made up, that it's a fantasy on Orton's part. But anyway, that's how Kenneth engineered the introduction between Orton and Clive Dennis. And the weird thing was that when the evening paper came and Orton's death was announced in the paper, by this time Kenneth already knew that Orton was dead because several people had phoned him throughout the day. But when the paper arrived, came through the door, and there's a headline on the front page, Clive Dennis had come back to fix that phone socket. Which was quite eerie. Kenneth dealt with bad news like that in a very detached way. His only defence was to maintain normal life, which is the very thing that Orton satirised so mercilessly in the lower middle classes. This, have a cup of tea and everything will be all right. When Williams' father died, the diary entry for that day says, received word that Charlie was dead at 3 o'clock. 4 o'clock, with Gordon Jackson to cinema to see Dr. No. That's what he did. Within an hour, his mother's off the phone, says your father's died, he's gone to the cinema to see the first James Bond film. And that is exactly what he did. He doesn't recall what film he went to see, but he went to the cinema as soon as he'd seen that newspaper. And it was weeks before Williams could even think about Orton as dead. He refused to make any comment to reporters, he refused to go on television programmes and discuss and dissect the murder. The thing that did for him was he picked up a book, not one that Orton had given to him, just something on his shelf, and he'd used as a bookmark a letter from Edna Wellthorpe. Now, there's no Edna Wellthorpes around the walls, but Edna was a character that Joe Orton assumed, who had an extremely unfortunate turn of phrase, which was full of double entendre and innuendo. She would, of course, not have been remotely aware of it. She was easily offended, and she was highly moralistic. And she'd written a letter to Kenneth in the guise of an agony aunt, and offering Kenneth advice about his personal life, completely misunderstanding what desires he had and what his nature was. I think she'd written something along the lines that, although the letter doesn't survive in Kenneth's archive, something along the lines that he was just waiting for the right girl to come along. And Kenneth opened this letter and he noted in his diary afterwards, he said, I started to read it and I started to laugh. And then I started to cry. Is that answer the question?
Yeah, very much so, yeah.
Any more? More questions? Hello.
Hi there. Just wondering, do we know anything about what Orton thought of the Carry-Ons? And is there any evidence that the Carry-Ons were in any way an influence on his work as a playwright?
I don't think I can perceive any influence at all, because Carry-On humour is resolutely working class, which is nothing to do with Orton's humour. The best Carry-Ons also are completely optimistic and based on the idea that we will cope with things only when we learn all to pull together. And that thread runs through all the Norman Hulis early ones and then through the later Carry-Ons. Talbot Rothwell's, the really famous ones, for starting with Carry On Spying. In all of them, the theme is there's an upper class and there's the poor bloody infantry. Literally so, in the first of the films, Carry On Sergeant, where the sergeant, William Hartnell, is determined to make his recruits the best squaddies in the training camp, and the squaddies are equally determined to do as little as possible until they all realise that they've got to help each other. That theme is taken into school, into the police force, onto a cruise ship, into the spy forces, all through history, the French Revolution, into the Wild West, into the Raj, and as long as that theme holds good, the Carry On films work. When you think of any of the ones that you don't like, say Carry On at Your Convenience, which ought to be funny, but isn't. It's the one with Sid James and Hattie Jakes as a married couple with a budgie that can predict the runner in the 3:30 at Kempton Park. That ought to be fantastic. I mean, what else do you need in a movie except a budgie that can predict the 3:30 at Kempton Park? But it doesn't work, and the reason is that Sid is the foreman, he's working class, but he's betrayed all the workers, and the whole of the movie is about how he outwits the trade union official and gets the better of the workers so that the bosses can continue in luxury and the workers can continue on minimum wage. It doesn't work at all. It's just a sad film. Where the series completely broke down was where it departed from that idea of us and them and Carry On Emmanuel. If you've ever had to sit through that, you'll know there's no us and them about it at all. And it's not a proper Carry On. There's no us and them in Orton. It's all them. It's me, Orton, sneering at them, who are too stupid to know that I'm sneering at them. Whether the middle classes actually were too stupid to know that, or whether they could see through Orton's ultimate shallowness, because that's if you don't believe at all in anybody's sincerity, if you believe that everybody is a hypocrite, I think ultimately you do have to be shallow, and that's why Williams and Orton never did understand each other at all. Although they were great friends and they loved each other's conversation, Williams loved to hear Orton's outrageous stories of exploits and orgies, the sort of thing that Kenneth would go away and fantasise about desperately but never dare attempt on his own. Or whether it was Orton listening to Kenneth's inspired streams of consciousness and the manic performances that he would put on for friends of he would do little snippets of every play that he'd ever been in, just run everything all together, a bit like that thing that I was talking about earlier of going on stage and just doing a rush of impressions so fast that you could barely pick out which one was which, but you knew that all of them were funny. Well, he would do that for friends and he would extemporise it, and Orton would just sit and listen to that. Stanley Baxter said that he met Orton once, Orton and Halliwell, called Halliwell the murderer. He said, "The murderer didn't say anything, he just served us with tea and biscuits." And I said, "Did you enjoy talking to Orton?" Stanley said, I never heard him say a word. Kenneth just talked. And I think that was what Orton liked about it. There would be this great rush of performance from Kenneth, who loved showing off to Orton. Orton, in a way, was everything Kenneth would have liked to have been. Middle class, intellectual, known for his writing, sexually adventurous, and uninhibited. Everything Kenneth really wanted to be. Tom Wayne said to me, Kenneth was in awe of Joe Orton. And certainly Orton adored having this film star friend who would put on a private performance for him and make him laugh till he wept. But they didn't understand each other at all. And the fact that Kenneth was incapable of understanding what Orton was driving at with Truscott and was incapable of finding a way of playing, that emphasised how little they were able to communicate. Because Kenneth Williams was not a shallow person at all. He was not a hypocrite. He tried very hard, when he was talking seriously, to say exactly what he felt and what he meant. And very often he would resort to either banal language or obscure language. He liked to talk about the ontological creed, in the knowledge that very few people would know what he was talking about. It's quite a simple idea, really. It's the notion that if we can conceive of God, there must be a God, because it would be impossible for us to imagine such a being if that being were not already in existence. It's a circular argument. And he took that very seriously. And when he did poetry readings on radio, and he did several, he would pick the poems which expressed his spiritual longings most deeply. And when he did those streams of consciousness, very often he would perform snatches of poems. There was a line of George Orwell's about the crystal spirit which no bomb can ever break. And that, to him, was the perfect description of the soul. And there's a lovely little passage which I found when I was reading through his notes that he made for his autobiography. He wrote his autobiography in pencil, longhand, and he wrote the notes for it on scraps of paper. And on the back of one envelope, dated about 1984, he wrote the consideration of Orton's personality. And he quite accurately said that Orton could not have lived a long time. Orton would only be about 81 now. Kenneth would be 85, and Orton would be 80 or 81. But he couldn't live to an old age, because he would destroy himself through his promiscuity. And that he was so intent on sexual expression at the most shallow level, and so averse to exploring the deeper emotional resonances of sexual relationship, that in the end, the pressure of having everything on the surface would cave him in. Which is exactly what did happen, quite literally. Skull caved in with a hammer. I mean, it's a very apt metaphor, that idea of eventually the surface being unable to withstand the weight and the blows to which Orton was constantly submitting it. Williams had a very deep religious faith to the end of his life. He believed that God was something which could not be understood or expressed in any language, and that it should be a concept approached as the very highest ideal of which one could conceive. So if you aspired to be closer to God, you made yourself as good as you possibly could be. And Orton, who would have regarded God as something completely unnecessary, he would have been atheist simply because he couldn't be bothered to believe in a God. Therefore, it's the opposite of the ontological creed. If I can't be bothered to believe in a God, then there can't be one. I mean, surely any God worth bothering about would force you to care about him. There would have to be something about him that would make life have meaning. And if life has no meaning, then there can't be a God. Another circular argument. And so completely opposite to Williams' very deep faith, that it really serves as the perfect illustration of what opposite characters they were. Anybody else? Is that beep saying shush?
Just a quick one. The title of your book is Born Brilliant.
Yes.
But the impression one gets to listen to your very interesting talk is that, in fact, Williams himself didn't believe that.
Mm.
And the way he ended his life, tragic ending, and he wasn't the only one, and Hancock did the same. I mean, how come the sort of brilliant comedians that they were, you know, could commit suicide and have such little faith in themselves in the end?
That title, Born Brilliant, comes from an interview with Bill Kerr, who is the only surviving main cast member of Hancock's Half Hour. He lives out in Perth. And I called him completely without his expecting it, because I only had his telephone number, I didn't have an address for him. Rang him and asked whether he would mind speaking to me at some point, and he immediately launched into 45 minutes of the funniest, most deadpan memories. He obviously loves doing interviews. And at one stage, I asked him what it was like working with Hancock and Williams and whether they were trying to better each other. And Bill said it wasn't that they were trying to beat each other. Hancock certainly wasn't like that. He wasn't a scene stealer. But if you're working with somebody who is streets ahead of you, you're going to look like a complete idiot. So you have no choice but to run desperately to catch up. And he said Ken was always out in front, even working with Hancock, who was probably the best sight-reading comedian of the post-war period, and capable of picking up a script and doing it to perfection without even knowing how the sentence ended. He had an instinct for the perfectly balanced line. And even Hancock had to work harder to keep up with Williams. And Bill said, if you saw Kenneth impromptu in the pub doing music hall stuff, or doing his army stuff, or in rehearsal making us laugh so much that we had to lie down on the floor because we couldn't breathe anymore, then you'd know that there was no other word for him. He was brilliant, and he was born brilliant. And that's where that came from. Because what really fascinated me about Williams was that he came from that exceptionally humble beginning that I described. He had no training at all. When he went to Newquay, all he had was his army experience. When he went into the Combined Services Entertainment, all he had was amateur shows in the NAFI in Ceylon, which can't be the best training ground for a young actor. And, you know, where did he get it from? Well, there was that mother of his who would do little song and dance routines for the customers in the barbershop. But in the end, you have to say, well, he was born like that. He was born with that extraordinary ability. And in fact, there's a lovely little letter in his archive from a man who'd known him when they were nine-year-olds at Manchester Street Junior School, just off King's Cross Road. And this man wrote to him and said, I heard your name, Kenneth Williams, but there's lots of Kenneth Williamses in the world, so I didn't associate it with you until I heard your voice. And I haven't heard you since you were 9 years old, and I suppose your voice has broken since then, but my goodness, you sound exactly the same. He had that voice when he was 9 years old. Did Ken believe in himself? Yes, he did. He knew that he was brilliant. He used to say, nobody can teach me anything. But he was shattered by that experience in Lute, that the discovery that there were certain parts which no amount of ingenuity could save, could rescue. He began after that to take the safer possible part. He hardly did any theatre. He did two plays after that, My Fat Friend, which he did a runner from. And he did something called Platinum Cat as well, which he also did a runner from. And The Undertaking, which he made a success of. He instead hid behind the very lucrative Carry-On, well, not very lucrative, but enough for his needs, the Carry-Ons, the radio work, Just a Minute, which he barely missed an episode for 20 years, Round the Horn, of course, all of the chat shows. There wasn't a chat show that he didn't appear on. Even by the end of his life, he was hosting the Wogan Show. And he knew he was streets ahead of most people. He would curse himself sometimes for not taking greater risks, but then on the other hand, he deliberately avoided the risks. He'd had the opportunity, many opportunities. And he didn't commit suicide. He died from an accidental overdose of a pharmaceutical which he sometimes took. Sleeping tablets, barbiturates. And his habit was never to finish the whole prescription, but to put a few aside in a jar. And by about 1985, he had a jar which had been filling for 15 years, which he called his exit jar. And he kept it in the kitchen. And a friend of his, Michael Whittaker, told me that it looked like a jar of Smarties. And he had an ulcer from about 1985, which was being treated with something called Zantac, which is an anti-inflammatory. And in the weeks before his death, the ulcer had flared up again, and he was facing an operation. He really didn't want the operation. He'd gone into hospital and he'd been looked at, and the surgeon had told him, "It's going to be a big job, Ken. It's going to be an arsehole to breakfast job." And Stanley Baxter said, "Arsehole to breakfast," he was not going to put up with. And so Ken decided he wasn't going to have an operation. He was just going to double his medication and make himself better and give up smoking. And he did. For the last 2 or 3 weeks of his life, he didn't smoke. And hated not smoking, I might say. He was really wretchedly miserable without smoking. But he was absolutely determined about it. And as Kevin Freud pointed out, you know, somebody who is intent on killing himself probably doesn't give up smoking for 2 or 3 weeks first. And certainly somebody who is deliberately killing himself, I would have thought, will go out and have a fag just to say goodbye to things. In the way that Tony Hancock, when he killed himself, had been off the booze for 2 weeks and that night went out and bought a half bottle of vodka, ostensibly to wash the tablets down with, but actually you can do that with water if you want. The point is, if you're going to kill yourself, it doesn't matter if you fall off the wagon first. I think that's just a little circumstance, but if Ken had wanted to kill himself, he could have had a fag first. The night that he died, he certainly took 2 or 3 of the barbiturates from the exit jar. He'd done that once before, and made a note in the diary the next day to see what the effect was. And the effect was that he slept very soundly and he woke up with a stinking headache the next morning. And so it was an experiment, just shuffling towards the edge of the platform to see how far the drop is onto the lines. But he certainly didn't jump off deliberately. He did die that night after having had 2 or 3 of those little tablets. The pathologist examined him and said that there were barbiturates in his system and not enough to kill him. There were amphetamines in his system and not enough to kill him. The action of the two, and anybody who takes amphetamines and barbiturates regularly knows that you shouldn't mix them, it's very dangerous. The action of the two was enough to induce a heart attack in his sleep. And I'm quite certain that he didn't take amphetamines and barbiturates together deliberately to kill himself. I'm not saying that he was sorry when he woke up the next morning and discovered that he was dead. I expect he was quite pleasantly surprised. And in fact, that friend, Paul Richardson, says that he dreamt of Kenneth that night. About 3 o'clock in the morning, he dreamed that he saw Kenneth standing, or rather hovering, in his room at the end of the bed with an absolutely ridiculous grin on his face. And Paul, half asleep and befuddled, actually thought it was Kenneth in his room. So he shouted at him to go away, and Kenneth vanished. Paul thought nothing of it until the next day, when he saw the crowds of reporters outside the flat, and he realised. What made me stop and think when I was researching the end of the book was amphetamines. Kenneth Williams. Really? Can you imagine Kenneth Williams on amphetamines? I mean, why? What on earth would he be doing with amphetamines? And why, when every single tablet that he'd ever taken since 1947, literally everything was noted in the diary. I could count the number of tablets that Kenneth ate in his entire lifetime, because everything is written down. Every sleeping tablet, every aspirin, all the cough medicine, the different ointments that he tried for his piles and his boils, everything. Never amphetamine. Never once. So, where did he get it from? It wasn't in the exit jar. Why would he have it? How would he know that amphetamine and barbiturate together were going to kill him? So I looked up Zantac, and guess what? Zantac, that thing for anti-inflammatory ulcer drug, guess what that shows up as when you do an autopsy? It's a false positive for amphetamine. What the pathologist saw as amphetamine was Zantac. If you remember, Kenneth had doubled the amount of Zantac that he was taking a fortnight before he died, without talking to Bertie Clark, his doctor. Just did it. Took it upon himself to double the dosage. And then took 2 or 3 barbiturates. And the stomach medicine with the sleeping tablets together were enough to kill him. But he certainly didn't kill himself. You could say that he died from rather recklessly mucking around with sleeping pills that he wouldn't normally take and that had been lying in a jar for years. I mean, you'd think that was a pretty stupid thing to do. but it wasn't suicidal. It's the answer to that. Hello?
Just on that point then.
Yeah.
It's actually really interesting because I remember stuff that I've read. A lot of people didn't believe that suggested that it did.
A lot of it's friends thought so, yeah.
But what I've often seen cited as the kind of justification for it is the last point of his diary saying, oh, what's the bloody point?
Yeah.
Is that right?
It does, indeed. The last words of the diary are, oh, what's the bloody point? And also, 1948, 3rd of April. The entry for that date ends, oh, what's the bloody point of it? So if it is a suicide note, it's 4 million words long, and it lasted 40 years. Anybody else? Hiya.
Yeah, just right at the start, you commented on the sentence that Orson and Halliwell received for the facing of library books. I'm a criminal defence lawyer myself.
All right.
And wondered how that type of sentence or that type of crime would be sentenced today. Generally, the sentencing regime over the last 50 years has gone up. I mean, the Misuse of Drugs Act and the so-called war on drugs has pushed drug sentencing up by about tenfold. Probably a more pertinent example would be the mobs and rockers fighting in the 1960s would have got sentences then that would be about a half or a third of what you get sentenced for similar violence now. So most of the trend has been up, but I still most of us still think instinctively that that sentence for this particular crime is very harsh. But I think that's partly filtered through a sort of nostalgia and an affection that we might feel for Orton, and we'd have to imagine if it was a similar type of thing, equally shocking to devaluing our library stock today, how it might be sentenced. Would it be equivalent, lower or higher? So with Mark's help and the museum, there's a proposal to recreate the trial of Orton. I'm going to be confirmed probably in January, where we're getting a prosecutor to advise on what charges might be brought now, because the type of offences have changed. Probably criminal damage and theft, but also maybe something under the Public Order Act for insulting behaviour, for causing shock, alarm, harassment or distress, something like that. And we're getting a contemporary district judge in, having heard the facts and any mitigation, to see what sentence might be passed and whether the current sentencing regime actually would be more liberal or actually harsher. So members of the audience might want to keep an eye out for that when there's a confirmed date, but probably January of next year.
That's fantastic.
I think we're looking at late January, I think. Just a very quick aside to that. Orton damages were awarded to Islington Council in civil action, totalling £262 at the time. We sort of roughly worked out today's money, what you could buy for that's about £4,000. And I was asking in an interview recently, If as a librarian, if you caught someone defacing books, would you prosecute? And even though, as you say, we've got this nostalgic thing for sort of Orton, so would I absolutely say yes, we would. Yeah. And let's see what happens when we do recreate. But
it's interesting, isn't it? Especially with the proposals at the moment to close so many libraries. You wonder whether perhaps members of the coalition government could be sent 6 months in prison. It's got to be worth pursuing, hasn't it? Is that it? Shall we?
I think so. I think it's absolutely. Fantastic. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Encyclopedic mind as well. I think all I can say is I must urge you to buy the book, which is on sale in the foyer there, just to obviously finish off the story or indeed start the story. Can I just mention a couple of